Our second reading today comes from Matthew chapter 14. Now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. But when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. Now when it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the day is now over. Send the crowds away to go into the villages and buy food for themselves." But Jesus said, "They need not go away. You give them something to eat." They said to him, "We have only 5 loaves here and 2 fish. And he said, "Bring them here to me." Then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing. Then he broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples. And the disciples gave them to the crowds. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. And those who ate were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. Immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the 4th watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, "It is a ghost," and they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." He said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." The word of the Lord.
You know, the best stories tap our emotions. They tap into the deep longings of our heart. They instill in us pictures of hope and imagination and expectation that are a part of who we are. One such story starts off this way: a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And then you picture this young man, this orphan boy, living on a farm with his aunt and uncle. And through the circumstances of the story, this young boy gets caught up in an intergalactic battle. And you find out that he is the one, the chosen one, who will battle evil. He's the one appointed to conquer and fight against the worst of the worst. Now, in real life, that story and stories like that capture the imagination of a real boy who some years ago heard stories like this. And in his own mind, he was filled with wonder. Could I be courageous like Luke? Would I be willing to battle evil? Would I be willing to put my life on the line? And so for that little boy, his dad's oversized t-shirts became Jedi cloaks, and anything that looked like a sword became a lightsaber, and any one became Darth Vader. As the boy grew, new stories captured his imagination. Pictures of sacrifice, like the men storming the beaches of Normandy, or stories of teenagers fighting to protect their homeland against enemy communist invaders. And these sorts of stories filled his mind with this idea of battling evil and greater purpose, so that his backyard became the mountains and every friend of his kind of contingent army. And those stories of imagination that get played out in little boys' lives were really, if you think about it, this idea that that boy wanted more in life. He wanted a life of meaning and of purpose. He wanted to be going somewhere and be a part of something. He wanted to have lasting impact in life. But of course, for that boy growing up, by the time he got to high school, things like sports and friends and girls and schoolwork and what are you doing on Saturday night began to crowd it all out. Essentially, reality crowded out that boy's imagination of having great impact in the world. Reality crowded out my imagination, obviously. Eventually, reality catches up, and those boyhood dreams of being Superman or Luke Skywalker kind of push to the side for more mundane things like getting into college and finding a job. But you know, each of us has a story. Each of us has a story or a narrative that tells who we are. And I'm not just talking about if I said, tell me about yourself, and you tell me about your past. I think there's actually in each of us not only a story about our past, but how we understand ourselves and what we are expecting about the future. We all have a narrative trajectory, what we think we're about and where we think we are going. But what I've also found is that those very narrative trajectories that project our hopes and our fears and our expectations, that they very often are swamped by the realities of life, so that hope and joy and expectation are kind of squashed. Much like if you can imagine Christopher Robin, the story doesn't go this way, but if Christopher Robin grows up and one day all he sees is a stuffed animal in his bedroom instead of Pooh and Tigger and 100 Acre Wood. Sometimes it's not just reality that kind of crowds out our hopes and dreams. Sometimes it is actually something that comes in and cuts them off. Charles Dickens, one of the greatest storytellers of all time, his final novel was The Mystery of Edwin Drood. It was supposed to be a 12-part novel, but 6 parts into the novel, Dickens died. We don't know how the story ends. We know that Edwin Drood, the title character, ends up disappearing, but we're not sure if he's dead or just disappeared. We assume he's dead, but we're not sure who the murderer is. The story simply ends. The last chapter's seemingly torn off, and we're left wondering, where does the rest of the story go? For some of us, the dreams of childhood, the dreams of kind of early adolescence, the dreams that you have when you're about to get married, give way to reality and the mundane. And sometimes tragedy comes in and rips the final chapters that you thought were going to be written in your life. We don't just have individual stories, we also have corporate stories that we kind of tell together. You can see corporate stories when you get a family together, because over the course of time, an extended family gathers and they tell and retell the same stories again and again. And so the story is something like, you remember how Grandpap, when he was age 12, had to start a job because his father ran out, and how he worked 2 jobs for years, and that becomes a part of the narrative of my family. Friends do this too. When you get any group of friends together, they tell and retell the same stories. Kind of like, remember that time when we were on that road trip late at night and we didn't realize that we were running out of gas and we looked for a gas station but couldn't find one, and so we went to the next one and the next one, and how we finally found a gas station. Or it's those insider jokes about things that happened in the past that friends have together. Like the time when one of you dropped chips into the other guy's milkshake and it nearly started World War III between the two of you. These sorts of stories get told and retold, and honestly, they are a part of what we call a collective narrative. When we tell these sorts of stories, they strengthen our bonds and our familiarity with one another, and they help define who we are and where we think we're going. Israel had a collective story. They had a story about what they were and where they were going based on what had happened and who they thought they were. In Nehemiah 9, which was the first passage that was read out of the scriptures today, we have the most common story that the Israelites had told and retold, and it's in the form of a prayer of confession. And the basic story of Israel that they told and retold was this: God, the Creator, chose a people through Abraham and his descendants to be his people in the world. In time, they went into slavery in Egypt, and for hundreds of years, they moaned and groaned under the bondage of slavery, and they called out to God, and God showed up. And when God showed up to arrive, he brought his servant Moses. And through his servant Moses, the people of Israel were led out of bondage from Egypt. They were redeemed. And in that process of redemption, God acted dramatically to part the Red Sea, so that they walked through the sea on dry land. And as they were being led in the wilderness for 40 years, God showed up to provide for them so that they did not starve, because he provided manna, bread from heaven in the wilderness. They eventually ended up in the land of Canaan, the promised land, and established a kingdom that stretched far and wide with peace and flourishment and prosperity under David and Solomon. But of course, you know how the story continues on. Israel's story is eventually cut off. Sin, idolatry, leads to exile. Eventually, the Israelites start to return to Israel, and that's what's happening in Nehemiah. But their return is never the same. They're never this big kingdom ever again. They go back to that story in Exodus as the ultimate defining point of their past. And they go back and say, when will God arrive like that again? And for hundreds of years, the people of Israel are longing for a prophet like Moses, for God to show up, to part the seas, to feed them in the wilderness, to establish a kingdom of peace, to redeem and restore them. And it's in the midst of that story that Jesus enters. Jesus enters the unfinished story of Israel, and he goes around healing sick people, forgiving sinners, challenging the religious leaders, and loving the outcast. And in Matthew 14, the episode that we had read today, there's a dramatic reenactment of Israel's story. You know the story, we just read it. The disciples and Jesus get in a boat in Capernaum and go across the Sea of Galilee, probably 5 miles or so, to a desolate region, an uninhabited part on the far shore. They're going over there to have some time alone, but everyone knows that this Jesus is doing and saying things that they've never heard and seen before. And so the crowd starts swarming around to that far side of the sea. And by the time they get to the shore, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people. Throughout the afternoon, Jesus is healing and teaching about the kingdom that he has come to establish. But by evening time, there are thousands of people gathered, and the disciples come to Jesus and they say, Jesus, what are we going to do? You got to send these people away. There's no villages nearby that can accommodate all these people. There's no food. They're hungry. And Jesus says, hey, you guys, you give them something to eat. Well, how can we, Jesus? We have a few loaves here. What are we going to do? Jesus takes the bread, he blesses it, he breaks it, he gives it to them. Now, where else have we heard that? Take the bread, give thanks, break, give. And the bread goes out, and everyone eats. Not just eats a nibble. Thousands of people that day eat to the full. They are satisfied, is the word that we are given. And then Jesus disperses the crowd, spends some time in prayer alone, and while he's praying that evening, he sends the disciples back across the sea. They're in a boat that's probably 25 feet long and about 8 feet wide, if the archaeologists are right, enough to fit about 15 men. It's a sailboat, and at least half of them were experienced sailors. This trip should have taken an hour, maybe 2 hours, 5 miles across the Sea of Galilee. But for hour upon hour, they are struggling. And by 3, 4, 5 in the morning, they are only halfway across the sea, because the winds that come out of Mount Horeb in the north, rushing down to this Sea of Galilee, which is 700 feet below sea level, create turbulent winds and great storms sometimes on the sea. So these men can't quite get the boat across, and they're struggling and exhausted. They've probably been awake for nearly 24 hours. And so when they see something, somebody walking on the water, they assume it's a ghost, and they cry out in terror. And Jesus calms their fears with these words: be of courage. It is I. Do not be afraid. Literally, be of courage. Ego a me. I am. Do not be afraid. You don't need to be afraid, because I am is here. The God of the past has shown up. Peter says, if it is you, Lord, tell me to come out. And Jesus says, all right, Peter, come on out. And Peter steps out of the boat and begins walking towards Jesus, his eyes fixed on Jesus. But we know he quickly is distracted by the wind and the waves, and he begins to sink. But he calls out, Jesus, save me. Jesus grabs him, picks him up, And the two of them enter the boat. And as soon as they sit in the boat, the water, the waves, the wind are calmed. And the disciples worship. They fall down and say, "Truly, you are the Son of God." What is Jesus' purpose in these dramatic acts? Well, in the first one, we see an act of kindness. He's feeding people, an act of compassion. In the second, it's a dramatic act of power, showing who he is. But I think there's much more going on here. And the reason why all four gospel accounts give this one miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, and three of them also follow it up with him walking on the water, is because it's an intentional reenactment of what God had done for Israel in the past. Remember Israel's story? The defining moment for them was the Exodus, when God showed up to redeem them. And when he did so, he parted the sea so that the people of Israel walked through the sea on dry ground. And then in the wilderness for 40 years, they were fed miraculously with bread from heaven. Jesus comes along and is gathering thousands of people in a desolate place, a wilderness, providing bread out of nowhere. And that very same night, he's walking on the water as if it's dry ground. The disciples understood exactly what he was doing. Maybe they didn't get it quite right then, but later on they certainly did. That what Jesus was doing was reenacting the Exodus. As one commentator put it, Jesus is declaring that the God of the Exodus, who divided the waters and provided manna in the wilderness, is at work in history again. Jesus is saying with these actions, the story of redemption has not ended. It's being written in and through me. But what I also love about this passage is not just that Jesus is kind of retelling a story and saying, "I am the fulfillment of all your hopes of the story that was cut off." It's that he also invites the disciples to enter the story. He doesn't just feed the 5,000. He says, "You feed them. You give them something to eat." And he invites them to participate with him in the process. He says to Peter, "Not just watch me walk on water, but you come. You join me out here. You see what it's like to stand upon the waters. You step out of the boat." So how do we do that? How do we enter the story that Jesus is writing, this story of redemption, the real divine story that God is writing over all of history and creation? Well, we do what Peter did. Get out of the boat. We get out of the boat. We trust him. You know, if you've ever felt like your story was incomplete, like something in your life was missing, I'm pretty sure the answer is not a new house or a boyfriend or a career change. Now, you might need to do those things, but that's not what's missing. If you've ever felt like the narrative of your life has been cut short, that something has come in and ripped out those pages by tragedy, like the loss of a spouse or a child, or like experiencing evil, abuse or rape, or simply a diagnosis comes in, like one old friend of mine who found out that her 2-year-old's wobbliness was not an imbalance problem, but an aggressive tumor in her brain. When something comes in and cuts our story short, we're left wondering what next. For some of us, it's just simply disappointment with where our life has ended up. You know, we started off all excited about getting married, and 20 years later, it feels like the two of you are just running a business. You take the night shift, I'll take the morning shift. You want kids, you're desperate for them, and then you deal with the frustration of, are these my kids? Or the other way around. Many of us get into life, and reality starts wearing us down, and we wonder, is this all there is? If that is the case, if the narrative of your life is not in the direction that you had expected and longed for, if the trajectory is not where you want it to be, if something is missing or ripped out, Jesus says, allow God's story. Allow the story that God was writing through Jesus, the story of redemption, to be written in and through your life. How do you enter the story? By responding to Jesus. You know, if you don't respond to Jesus as the disciples did that day when they fell down, then you are necessarily writing your own story. You are God of your life. The trajectory of your life is being determined by you. But once you say, you, Jesus, are the Son of God, once you allow yourself to be astonished by what Jesus does, once you step out of the boat, so to speak, and put your whole life in his hands, then Jesus says you're entering the real story. Then for the first time, true purpose and meaning and lasting impact will define who you are. In my life, I kind of entered that story as a boy. But I find that it's hard because I am constantly trying to write my own story. And I find that to the extent that on a given day or week, I'm writing the narrative of my life, I find that I am more fearful because I realize I have to control the outcomes. And there's just so many things I can't control. Or I'm more discontented because the kind of demands that I create when I'm writing the story are all about me. And if you're not feeding me, then I don't like you. It ends up ruining my relationships, causing great disappointment and frustration where there shouldn't be. And also, when I'm writing my own story, I have no way to account for loss or tragedy or failure because those things just can't happen. But when I enter the story, when I fix my eyes on Jesus and allow him to write the story of my life, to define what is good and right and true and where I am going, what's important, I find that I have more joy, more pleasure, more purpose, more satisfaction, more peace. And it's not just that all of a sudden I enter some great narrative and I'm doing all sorts of amazing things. It's that even the mundane is filled with purpose when Jesus is writing the story of my life. So it's not that by entering Jesus' story that all of a sudden I get to drink magical potions in some fairy tale instead of sipping coffee in the morning, or that all of a sudden I'm giving kind of stirring speeches in front of armies in some epic film instead of just talking with a neighbor. It's instead that cup of coffee that I'm enjoying in the morning now is infused with a sort of meaning where I realize that God is the one who made me in his image with taste buds and pleasure sensors. And so with every sip, I can rejoice and thank God and praise him. And I'm even pointed in that good cup of coffee towards eternity, to that day when pleasures will be unceasing forever. It's not that conversation with that neighbor is filled with all sorts of importance on some mega level. It's that I realize that in talking with this person, if they too respond to Jesus, that this is going to be a friend that I walk with and laugh with and enjoy for the next billions and billions of years. And in the meantime, every interaction I have, every conversation, every connection, every act of friendliness or love in between us hits on something deep inside of me. Because in just an interaction with a friend, I realize that I am made to know and be known. I'm made to know and be known by God and by you, that we are made for relationships. And it's a part of God's big redemptive purposes in our lives. And so a cup of coffee or a conversation with a friend can be filled with purpose and lasting meaning when we enter the story of redemption that Jesus is writing. The best stories tap into our imagination and our hopes and our longings. The best stories are filled with some common themes. You know what some of these common themes are? Reinvention and redemption, according to Anne Rice and F. Scott Fitzgerald. And I would expand that out to say, the best stories, the ones that you guys like, that I like, the novels we read, the films that we watch that we're really moved by, they have these common themes. Reinvention, which is basically a way of saying creation. They have good and evil and justice. And they have redemption and resurrection, or some parts of one of these. So think about it. The theme of recreation, you find this in Rocky, who becomes more than just a bum from the street. Or in Rooster Cogburn, who's recreated as a man of sacrifice and honor in the Western True Grit. You see good battling evil and seeking justice when Luke battles Vader, or some hobbits try to put a stop to Sauron. And you see great themes of redemption in a book like Crime and Punishment, where in the end, Raskolnikov, the murderer, receives mercy and redemption. Or you see him in a film or book or play like Les Mis, where kind of all the themes are present. I'm going to say that one of two things. Either the Bible's writers were kind of hitting on the same sort of thing that Dickens and Fitzgerald and all these others hit on, which is any good story has creation and fall and redemption and evil and resurrection. And they were just trying to write a good fairy tale. And Jesus seemed like a good leading character. But it's all just made up, and it just happens to be a really good narrative, right? And we all tap into it the same way we tap into any good movie or book. Or perhaps every good writer, every good filmmaker, every good storyteller is tapping into something which even they might not realize is true. That we are made to understand a deeper story about a creator, about our fall from him, about the redemption that he offers us and the hope of resurrection and restoration. And so they write these stories that we love, and they don't even know why they're doing it. But they're tapping into something we are made for a life that is bigger, for the life that is told in Jesus Christ, that story of redemption. Here we are on a stage, right? Plays are shown here. I remember watching a few. I went to school here. Shakespeare said, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players." And that's essentially what I've been saying. This world is a stage, and all of us are players. But the reality is that most of us demand to write our own story, to define our own narrative trajectory. But when we do this, it's like performing a monologue in a closet. Jesus comes along and says, "The world's stage is mine. The drama is being written by and through me." But he invites us onto the stage to participate in the story with him, to let his story be written in and through our lives so that we might know life to the full and forever. Life to the full and forever does not mean that everything will always go easy for you when you enter Jesus' story. It does not mean that you will be protected from physically drowning, but it does mean you will be forever kept from drowning spiritually and eternally. You know, in the ancient world, the sea, the waters, were the symbol of evil and death. Jesus comes along, and he himself experiences the fullness of evil and death on the cross. You see, on the cross, Jesus kind of metaphorically was drowned in our place. He was plunged to the depths so that we can stand on the water, so that we who put our trust in him will walk all over Satan and sin and death. Each of us hungers for purpose and for meaning and for love and for success and for pleasure. But the bread we really need is Jesus. If we come to him, we will be satisfied. Let's pray. God, you made us in your image to know you, to know life to the full, to be fed by you, to conquer Satan, sin, and death. But apart from you, we write our own story. God, give us faith. It doesn't have to be great faith. It can be that kind of doubting faith that Peter had as he got out of the boat and began to sink. Give us the faith to get out of the boat, to put our trust in you, the one who wants to write our story now and always. Amen.
Oh, the deep, deep love of Jesus, best unmeasured, boundless free, rolling as a mighty ocean in its fullness over me. Underneath me, all around me, is the current of your love, leading onward, leading onward to your glorious rest above. Oh, the deep, deep breath, all I need. Trust is the deep, deep love of Jesus.
Sing that with us again. Oh, the deep, deep love.
Oh, the deep, deep love. All I need.